Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, May 21st, 2011. My name's Marcia Mary Baker, and our headline topic for today is Eco-Fascists Trounced in Sweden. And I'm very glad that we're able to have with us, direct from Stockholm, our guest Portia Törnborg-Strid. Welcome, Portia.
Hi, Marcia.
And Portia, some of you know, she's been on the show, and you have other reasons to know her over the years. She's based, Portia, you're based in Berlin, Germany, right?
Right, right.
But Portia's from Africa, from Zimbabwe, and has been active, as I say. We've had her on the show really as a warrior angel against the imperial geopolitics that's been devastating the world and presenting a real development perspective in opposition to this. I'll just mention in passing, before I introduce our next guest, that the latest EIR online has an adapted transcript of a wonderful video of a development perspective for North Africa, for Africa and Southwest Asia, called The Blue Revolution, which Portia and the Schiller Institute in Germany produced some weeks back. So we'll give the website, but we'll be talking about that. In Stockholm, which Portia will get to shortly, is where Portia was part of the team that absolutely drew the line and routed an attempted stealth meeting of these these global fascists, part of this John Schellnhuber crowd, British echo agent type guy. So, but before we get to that, I'm very glad to have as our second guest, welcome Alicia Saratani.
Hello.
And Alicia is there in the LPAC war room, and in particular, we're keen to have Alicia or someone from her team to discuss the kind of, it's the same topic, but the kind of mobilization topic, that is, we're going to have Glass-Steagall, it's a do-or-die question. And related to all this, two new web pages have been put up on LaRouchePack.com, and that's what Alicia will be telling us about. It's just in the last couple of days, and I hope many of you got her email. She's editor-in-chief of this LPAC operation. And so, Alicia, why don't you kick things off by describing the thinking behind doing this, which amounts at the same time to a kind of a situation report on where we are in enforcing a shift in the world.
Okay. Well, the two pages that we launched from LPAC, the first is an updated Glass-Steagall page, which we have launched to keep up with the mobilization, not just in the United States, but across the planet, because the need for Glass-Steagall is so dire, and more people are recognizing that. So we launched this page to specifically as an organizing tool that people can rely on, not just for video material, but also for printed material and a history, a context for what this very profound piece of U.S. legislation has the power to do right now, which is essentially let the monetary empire die on the vine if we in fact decide to act on the principles of the U.S. Constitution. That went up in the beginning of the week. The second page that we launched from LPAC is called Mastering Forces of Nature, which also couldn't have come a moment too soon, because this is the page itself is a feature of everything that LPAC has produced since the inflection point of March 11th, which, as people know, was the magnitude 9 earthquake and tsunami in Japan. That event really has served as an inflection point, as a wake-up call for people on this planet to understand that there is, in fact, no harmony or balance in nature that we are supposed to be submitting ourselves to or subordinating ourselves to, as someone like Hans Schellnhuber might insist. But instead, there are very powerful forces in nature. There are very powerful forces in which our Earth and solar system are a part of that are actually ours to master if we understand what we're doing. So the intention of that page is to educate people, have a mass education of what kind of phenomenon we're dealing with when we're dealing with earthquakes or volcanoes or severe unprecedented weather, as we've seen here in the United States, that these things are not isolated events, but these things are part of a process which we as mankind have a very unique role in directing, as a matter of fact. But there's a scientific and political revolution that needs to take place in order for us to really wield that authority. So, and the two things, like I said, couldn't have come out, the two pages couldn't have been launched they could have been launched a long time ago, but they came out just in time, because as the this week in particular has been marked by a very profound shift globally. And as most people know, last weekend the IMF chief was arrested and thrown out of that position. And for the insightful viewers, you recognize that this wasn't just a sex scandal. What Dominique Strauss-Kahn represents is the leading spokesperson for this failed process of bailouts. Now, this is very interesting. Someone else out there now understands what Lyndon LaRouche understands, which is that if there were one more bailout of the magnitude that Strauss-Kahn, Geithner, and Bernanke, the three of them in particular, were planning, we would see a disintegration of the entire global system. Now, this is the beauty of it. Because that was a case that was always the case, we have a U.S. Congress who's and as a body terrified to act on the implications of passing something like a Glass-Steagall through and putting an end to that. Instead, other forces moved to knock out Strauss-Kahn, which has fundamentally shifted the entire global situation right now, the entire global playing field. And it puts Glass-Steagall right on the table. Whether people want to... Whether or not people want to admit it's the right policy, it is the right policy. It's the only policy. It's the only way we're going to be able to survive and maintain a functioning global financial system. And we're at a time where people who are fighting for the future of mankind, they're going to be very strange allies, unassuming allies. And this is what we've seen in this past week. So these are a couple of things that we've put out really as organizing tools, as a mass educational process, because everybody right now is affected both by the fundamental political shift, but that fundamental political shift is in turn affected by serious changes in solar and galactic cycles that we still need to know a lot more about before we can principally act on them.
Right. Let me throw in here one aspect of the power. It's an observation. You may want to say more about it or not, in terms of the having there the tools, all you described, Glass-Steagall, what's happening in different parts of the U.S., different localities. It's not as if it's just an additive thing, one more signature a day from Congress, although that wouldn't hurt, right? But it's like creating a whole field, new field potential to make something happen. Here's a time question, overnight. Mm-hmm. But one thing is in the last 24 hours, Portia, you may not know this yet or something, but, you know, there has been this reigning idea that you can't really forecast, as Obama said, you can't control or forecast earthquakes, you can't forecast hurricanes, you can't. The lead thing that you have on Mastering Forces of Nature on this new page, which is the Russian scientist, Mr. Pulinets, who was interviewed in Vienna by Porsche's colleagues there, and the Russian scientists and his team are saying they studied 24 earthquakes and they can find precursor phenomena that's knowable. And this, so even though there's been a lid on this kind of thing in the major media and among science networks, in California, which is right in ground zero of where there's likelihood of seismic huge activity, ABC TV last night, ran portions of that interview from LPAC TV on Poulinette saying this. So it's just, you don't know. It's not, you're not trying to one for one get something like this to happen, but it creates a breakout situation that this is part of, right?
Yeah. Well, I would add to that. I mean, with the case of the pending solar and galactic threat, and even with Glass-Steagall, these are the fact that we cannot exist as a functioning modern society without a principle of economy as reflected in Glass-Steagall. That is a truth. I would say that those things actually have a more profound physical existence as truths themselves. Whether or not it is acted on, mm-hmm. that becomes the margin of difference. That then becomes the medium in which all these other political phenomena play out. It's that there are certain things, there are certain lawful processes that need to be achieved, need to be striven for. In the exact same vein, the fact that whether or not there is the political will or the scientific capability at the time being to begin mastering these forces of nature. And I mean literally managing the Earth's earthquakes, tornadoes, weather. Whether or not we can do that right now, it doesn't take away from the fact that we as a species, in fact, are capable of doing that. And that truth is the most relevant, powerful force, I would say, at play. Now, the political situation that we find ourselves in is whether or not we are achieving those things, whether or not we are striving for and acting on those truths. So it's when you see some of these developments, you have a population in San Francisco who, or another, any part of the Pacific Rim for that matter, who are sentient of this sort of fate. The real interesting part politically is, how quickly can we bring people up to speed to recognize that, you know, this is answering these questions, preparing for these sorts of things actually really is what one's life ought to be spent achieving.
Right. Do you want to, I'll just tell everyone listening, people know we're archived and so forth, but it's the LaRouche Show, May 21st, 2011. And I'll throw out that Alicia's going to have to leave to go to other things in about 15, 20 minutes. So, but Alicia, do you want to say anything else about the, there's another side of this. People being sentient, Americans right now who are in the disaster zones. Now, that's a huge stretch of the country, even without a major earthquake, the tornadoes, the Mississippi Basin flooding, the drought in Texas and northern Mexico. But the fact of Obama and the people, that people, even if they aren't informed, they know he's not his own man. Mm-hmm. He's just telling people to roll over and die. The Haiti treatment. Do you want to say something about that negative side people are sensing too?
Yes. I mean, in a certain sense, you have a negative proof of how profound the office of the U.S. president is by what Obama is not doing. He represents a vacuum of leadership that this country and the rest of the world requires to make our way through one of the history's greatest financial collapses, but also a very unique time in man's history on the planet. The United States is a crucial nation for providing leadership in something like this, and you have a president who is exactly what Lyndon LaRouche outlined in April of 2009, is that his concern, and other reports corroborate this, he really has no concern for the hard work of the president. He's not necessarily concerned with the foreign policy. He's not necessarily concerned with setting things into motion in a way that a president uniquely can. I mean, if you think about the kind of mobilization required were a magnitude 8, 9, or 10 earthquake to strike San Francisco, that entire chain of command from the Army Corps to FEMA, all of the emergency response at the federal, local, and local level, that all ends up at the doorstep of President Obama. And he is, and this is not an opinion, he is just frankly not interested in that job. So the challenge becomes the challenge becomes, once that becomes obvious to many members of the Congress who have the power to remove him from office, is recognizing that he's not in there at his own whim. He's in there to play out a very particular, to render the United States very incapable of dealing with these sorts of things. So other forces represented by Bernanke, Geithner, Strauss-Kahn, this whole international faction of finance and banking, if you have a president who is sort of indifferent to the role of the U.S. president in office, then these other forces can run roughshod over the United States and use it to their advantage, which is exactly what they've done with the bailouts. So what's very interesting now is that that whole playing field just shifted in a big way, not in favor of this international financial faction. But the question is, will the United States Congress and will the United States people be able to pick up on that strategy and say, we have a constitution, there's no reason why he has to stay in office, we absolutely can remove him. And because we are clear on what the policy must be, which is also there available in our history, with something like emergency measures of Glass-Steagall, but also rebuilding the nation, which we know how to do, and other nations would work with us to do that.
Right. It comes to mind, I mean, this is just the tiniest instance, but in the 1927 flood in the lower Mississippi Basin, in which there were levees going back a couple hundred years before that, they weren't much, but under the French colonial time, but there was a perspective in a 1928 act to build an entire flood control system on the lower Mississippi, and it was pretty much built, which would be comparable today to have been building NWAPA on our continent, North American water, at least intercontinental projects. So what you say, there are precedents, there's a long reflex, deep reaction. It's just like all those Irish and Italian cops in New York City that must be happy to stick that bum in jail.
Yeah.
I think as one of your LPAC TV said, you know, aren't Americans great? But let me ask, Portia, do you want to say anything from not just a geographic but a political strategic vantage point in Europe? We do want to get to hear your firsthand report from Stockholm, but about the Eurozone blowout, this whole shift with it's like the scandal against Tony Blair. It isn't just a limited political war scandal. There's whole factions opening up. Do you want to say anything about the view of the drive, the LaRouche drive in the U.S. for Glass-Steagall, how that's perceived in Europe, or the huge demonstrations in Spain, anything at all?
Well, it's very interesting right now because from the European standpoint, I was wondering if Alicia could go into this a little bit more, because I think the taste for victory really has to get here. I know that at the beginning of May, you had, for example, the head of BaFin, Jochen Zanio, here in Germany, who testified at the beginning of May in the Bundestag, in the German parliament, that there could not be another round of bailouts for the euro because the taxpayers would basically hang them all. So there is a certain sense of the fact that this system is coming down and there's really nothing they can do. In fact, when Dominique Strauss-Kahn was on the way back to Europe, sitting on that flight in New York, that's when he got arrested. He was supposed to meet with Angela Merkel to discuss, you know, the question of the bailouts, how they were going to get that through. And just as he was about to do that, you know, they were having this emergency meeting. They were, you know, frantically trying to prevent a Greek default, because basically if Greek debt is restructured, or as Jean-Paul Juncker calls it, the soft restructuring, where they might get a little bit of a haircut, has basically freaked out all the rating agencies here where they are not willing to give Greece anything more if Greece doesn't carry on with these this austerity policy, which is the reason why there is all this it's going completely out of control with the strikes, with the mass strike phenomenon here in Europe. But the nature of the derivative bubbles is such that the smallest gap in liquidity would blow the thing sky high. So basically these empty threats from the European Central Bank to Greece would mean that they would be shooting themselves in the foot. So, you know, the key thing here is that the Eurozone is finished. And they know that. The secret meeting that the European finance ministers had saying that Greece might have to leave the euro would really mean the unraveling of the euro system. And that, you know, all the things that the Germans were made to believe, the mantra of Europe being stable, united, peaceful, because of the dictates of the Lisbon Treaty, has proven to be a complete myth. And the question of going back to a sovereign currency, going back to the Deutschmark, is really uppermost in people's minds. And I think that what's going on in the U.S., which we have to communicate here, is the sense that, you know, Dominique Strauss-Kahn is likely to probably have company in prison very soon, because of the Angelides report and the Levin report basically coming out now and being used to look into the books of some of the major banks in the United States from the standpoint of the so-called New York State Martin Act of 1921. And, you know, like Richard Trumka coming out also from the FAL-CIO union, he's the president of that, coming out and saying that they're not going to support the Democratic Party anymore in 2012 if these kinds of things continue. I think that people here should get more of a sense of how this process is really coming to a head. And I don't know, Alicia, could you say more about that?
Yeah, I think that if you look at the whole political landscape, and this is the genius of LaRouche, is that you really do need, you can only look at the events in juxtaposition with something else to have a sense of what's happening out there. And that's how one can understand the events leading up to the chief of the IMF getting tossed out for sake of the, you know, for sake of the whole system staying together for a couple more days or weeks. Because there are going to be people who recognize that, that the system that they've been a part of is crashing. And there are going to be people who you otherwise might consider enemies who begin also to defect from this crumbling system. For a long time now, there have just been, particularly since 2007 and 2008 when the bailouts began, that whole thing was a bluff. It was never going to work. The problem, and this gets into the incredibly relevant intervention that your team over there just made, is that a lot of these guys in finance who've been bluffing with the bailouts, they, most of them may not necessarily know that they've been deployed by an international empire, British Empire, to push a policy of depopulation. And that we've gotten to a point right now where things are so, the system is so rotten, and it is, everybody can smell it. And you have, you know, a number of people defecting, a number of things happening, like what happened to Strauss-Kahn. But then you sort of see the real players at hand, which is, if people could actually believe it, the environmentalist movement in a certain way are actually more evil than the worst of the worst financial banking types. Why? Because they actually are prepared to lower the world's population, and they think that they can get away with it. So they're evil, but they're also stupid. So, and this is the interesting thing. This is what I was bringing up about looking at different events in juxtaposition with one another. I don't think it is a coincidence that that moves were made to push, at the same time that moves were made to push the this network of people internationally who were trying to force a bailout of the world system. At the same time that was happening, there was a coordinated effort to move in and push a rabid depopulation population reduction program in Germany, throughout Europe, and then also into the United States through the Obama administration. That those two things were happening, that those two things are happening simultaneously, is not a coincidence. It's indicative of actually the state of affairs that mankind now finds himself in. So the shift on the political financial side of things, in terms away from bailouts, it's not a happy ending quite yet by any means. But that in coordination with the fact that this genocidalist movement that really is centered in the British monarchy, they sort of infected a bunch of other people to think in their bestial ways. The fact that movement has just taken a big blow because of an expose of that's exactly what they're trying to do, it really gives people an upper hand if they have the guts to look at the world and history in that light. And that's our task, is to bring people into this incredible process of history, the present, and the future by having the courage to look at it in terms of these processes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that impact of this, the appreciation, I mean, we said we appreciated the NYPD, New York City Police Department, Irish-Italian ranks especially, getting a kick out of the same thing, giving these fruitcake fascists a big hit in Stockholm after the last 30 years has a big resonating effect on the whole shifting situation anyway around the world, but certainly in the United States. Should we, Alicia, do you want to ask anything else? Or maybe, Portia, you should go ahead with what did happen in Stockholm this week.
Oh, it was fun. We had a lot of fun because a lot of the people who visited who were the elite guests of this symposium were some old friends of ours that we had a reunion with in front of the Swedish Royal Academy of Sciences. On the Monday, May 17th, we met up with them because they had set up this third Nobel Laureate Symposium on Global Sustainability, which should have been called, you know, the Symposium on Global Fascism, because it was nothing different, especially considering that they had invited John Schellenhuber to be the person opening up the symposium with a speech. And what we did is we had a banner, a big banner saying what Schellenhuber does not wish to know, human life is sacred, which gets to the real point of evil that Alicia was discussing about these people, because the idea of the whole symposium was to ram through a fascist manifesto saying that, you know, we're going to stop scientific and technological development because we need to reduce human-caused global warming and climate change, and we need to manage the limited resources of the planet in a sustainable way, and so on and so forth, by reducing the world population. And they had what was called the Stockholm Memorandum, which had been drawn up with several points, which these Nobel laureates that were and others that were invited in on the discussion, a closed door discussion, were supposed to sign on this after, you know, a day of discussion, basically, and then it was open to the public the next day after they had signed it, right? Mm-hmm. So what we did was we went there and we said, okay, we have to warn these people if they don't already know who Schellenhuber is, what is the agenda here? And it was really funny because what was a very good flank was the fact that they had a bust of Anders Retzius, who is basically the father of Swedish eugenics, you know, right out in front of the Royal Academy of Sciences. And we just basically pointed out that to people that it's interesting that they're holding this secret fascist meeting with these oligarchs, and the bust of this you know, eugenicist genocidalist was right out in front, which was, you know, the irony of the whole thing. And that got people talking, you know, that this was being done, you know, as a conspiracy, with the, you know, the public not being allowed to know what was going on. And when we ran into these people, we were distributing the leaflet that Hussein Askari, who's the chairman of the LaRouche movement in Sweden, that he had written for the occasion with the headline, Stop Global Eco-Fascism. We had a lot of raised eyebrows, you know, as they received the leaflet. And, you know, we got into some very interesting discussions where some of them, you know, were willing to defend the fact that they wanted to decarbonize the whole economy, that they wanted to basically, you know, eliminate the option of nuclear power. But because we stuck to our guns, because we basically told everybody, look, they want to stop economic development. Africa needs nuclear power. And, you know, the key question of reducing the population is a fascist idea. We had one picket saying humans against global fascism, and another one that I was holding saying that lesson number one from Copenhagen, the third world rejects CO2 colonialism, which got in, you know, provoked some interesting discussions where, you know, it still hurts that Copenhagen did not basically ram through fascism as they'd wished. So now they were going to do this, you know, behind the back door, sign the Stockholm Memorandum and hand it over to the United Nations. And suddenly that would become official United Nations policy on a global scale. We were not going to let them get away with this. So we filmed the whole thing. We had some interesting discussions. And the key thing is that we ran into some guys like Hans Blix, who was the former head of the IAEA, who basically said, look, I know you guys, I know LaRouche, and I'm not going to sign this this memorandum. Obviously, he is pro-nuclear. And at the end, the what was rejected by these guys, by the laureates, was actually the section that was discussing energy policy. They rejected that because it had, you know, this insane idea about, you know, reducing climate change and global warming by 2 degrees and so on and so forth, stopping CO2 emissions. And even though they still had the part about reducing human pressures and, you know, reducing the birth rate, which I don't know how more clear you have to be that you want to kill off the whole population, that was something that we would basically attribute to the fact that we were very aggressive about this question on nuclear. And this is something that we kept bringing up. They saw us everywhere. We weren't just there at the beginning of the conference. We were there basically in the evening at the concert that they had. Then we were there the next day at the press conference. Then we were there the day after that when they had the open thing. And I think, you know, Sharon Hoover was starting to have nightmares that if he went to the toilet, he would see our banner, you know, in the toilet. So he probably, you know, had to hold it in. But that was really, really fun because, you know, they got the message. They definitely got the message that we were not going to let them get away with it.
That's great. Let me break in here because Alicia may have had to leave already. Are you still there, Alicia?
I'm still here.
Do you want to say anything, or if you have to leave, we're going to thank you, but you tell us.
I better hop off right now, but thanks. Thank you very much for having me.
Anyway, so we'll be making more mention of the absolute essential web pages. But thanks a lot, Alicia. We're going to continue to talk with Portia. Thank you.
Have fun.
Okay. Portia, this is great to get the firsthand report to see Sharon Hoover in under pressure himself, right?
Oh, he's really spooky.
Uh-huh.
He just did
not say
anything.
Uh-huh.
When we were asking him, for example, how history would judge him, because his proposals would basically lead to a Holocaust worse than Hitler's. And, you know, we had his face, you know, in front of a camera, he didn't say anything, and he just went into the symposium stone-faced. But I think that he got very, very nervous seeing us again and again. And the fact that we had discussions also with basically the other organizers of the conference. One other guy, Johan Rockström, who was the actually the chairman of the symposium, had to defend basically the fact that they were having it, and he immediately went to the fact that, you know, the way they want to help third world countries and poor countries around the world is by actually making sure that the rich countries go reduce their own carbon emissions and stop nuclear in their own countries. And I said, well, you know, maybe you don't have to kill, you know, off the people in the rich countries in order to save the poor countries. And he wasn't very happy about that. But I mean, the thing that they are saying, basically the key brainwashing element, is the fact that they think that the world is a closed system.
Uh-huh.
They have no idea about all the things that Alicia was going through in terms of, you know, how the universe really works when they're seeing the planet. Hello, am I still on?
Oh, yeah, very clear. Yeah, you're fine. Mm-hmm. That was just
That is a real problem with these people. So,
right.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun.
And, you know, just to underscore what Alicia was saying about the to have to hand the kind of thinking that goes on, I noticed on one of the new websites, the Mastering Nature, for example, there is an article posted by a man in the Southwest United States, I think his name is Mr. Voltz, and he has been interviewed on his view. He's a land preparations for construction site preparation. He's been interviewed on North American Water and Power Alliance, and in March he wrote an article on agriculture, how you are going to feed billions of people in the world on our planet. And there it is, completely available on Mastering Nature, just at a time. It's just the complete refutation of what you say, Portia, about this Stockholm Declaration, this advance released by Schellnhuber, this report in Germany that Helga Zepp-LaRouche has issued a broadside against. They say you can't feed everyone. It's not possible. All the resources are being used up. You have to have less land. People should not be eating meat. And so it just shows the kind of resources to hand when you're out there organizing and want to beat someone over the head. And in particular, one thing that impressed me with the Stockholm Resolution and the report we mentioned, the Schellnhuber Gang report, is it's specifically the major companies of the world that already own a huge amount of the world food chain, like Nestle's, mm-hmm. Unilever, by name, are the ones that are cited as companies that will be win-win, they say. Yeah, win for the royal genocidalists to come in and control who eats what they eat and so forth. But do you want to say anything about this?
It goes into what Helga, for example, said in her appeal to people to shut this thing down, that what their idea of how the world works or how humanity interacts with nature, mm-hmm. is that humanity is supposed to act as, you know, stewards of nature. The idea that we're bookkeepers or, you know, administrators of nature, right? That we have to kind of share the resources, and some people get a little bit more, some people get a little bit less. Leaving aside the idea, first of all, that who actually does the sharing out? You know, they always have this question of governance, which is, you know, a very interesting word to use, because it's not government, it's governance. And that means that, you know, these shady characters are the ones, you know, quack scientists that are going to say, well, we have this model. This is how we're going to share out the resources. They're limited. And basically, we have to give people peanuts and kind of share them out as we see fit. But regardless of that fact, the main thing is that when we look at agriculture, we're looking at a scarcity of water. Like, that is the main problem that we have. Looking at, for example, North Africa and the question of the Sahara, you have, as Roosevelt clearly saw in the early 40s, he saw that this was a huge potential in terms of basically irrigation, and the fertility of the soil in the Sahara was second to none. All it needed was irrigation. And he also knew that the what he called underground river systems existed. And this is something that we were discussing in the Blue Revolution, whereby we said, okay, you have a whole bunch of depressions, vast areas in Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, and so on, of salty marshlands, where you could actually bring water in from the Mediterranean, salt water. You would desalinate that, and you would be basically bringing that in to be able to change the climate, as we have been proposing with the whole NWAPA model of how we would do this, changing the climate. But also, you'd be doing something very interesting with this concept that was brought up first by Roudert, a French topologist, who discussed the fact that what you would be doing when you're bringing in this water from the Mediterranean, you would be using a system of canals, whereby you would actually be washing out the salts of the marshlands over a couple of years, and basically bringing it back up the Mediterranean, sort of recycling it that way, and making that prime land for agriculture. And what you have also developed, interestingly enough now, is you have rice that's developed as halophytes that actually sucks up, it uses salt water to grow. And you would be actually using that, you know, to feed people at the same time. But without this type of idea of how you're actually bringing in, you know, a certain type of improvement to nature by using what nature already does, but on a higher level. What you know, the question of what LaRouche talks about in terms of platforms, mm-hmm. you would actually be able to generate more water and more food, which is when we, if we would distribute all the water that's being desalinated on the planet every day, we could distribute 7 liters of water per person to drink every day. Fantastic, right? Mm-hmm. But then we wouldn't have anything to eat, because that water being used for irrigation is 1 cubic meter of water per square kilometer of land, which is nothing, basically. Mm-hmm. Right. So this question of actually not just sharing it out and having, you know, a balance of nature, that is out. What we have to do as human beings, understand the processes that are happening and actually improve upon them, so that you actually upgrade nature for the needs of man. And that is really a challenge that we should happily accept, because that's the fun thing to do.
Right. Well, let me ask you more. You may want to make other points in our remaining quarter of an hour, but on our shows, at one point, I know in the past, it might have been a couple years ago, Portia, that you were saying the arrogance of these pseudo-environmentalists that are just going to assert there's one fixed point in time where we assert everything has run out, and we're going to have this bookkeeping, and you're going to get less, and we're going to get everything. That this is so extreme, I understand, or extreme, so it stands out. It's the character of what this evil is. I understand that this 4-day event where you were in set of events in Stockholm, they had entertainments and poetry and whatnot. There were such things as someone was holding forth about how in Bhutan there's a gross domestic happiness index that everybody should use. Crazy stuff. Is that? Do you run into all this stuff?
Well, that's really voodoo. Yeah. I mean that you know, you have it everywhere. I mean, this the fact that we've gone away from science, the mm-hmm. fact that we've gone away from really looking at the way processes work, and we go to mathematical models, we can basically make up indices for anything that we want.
Yeah, that's
to,
true.
You know, based on whatever we make up. But the question is that really what's going on in real life? You know, I'll take the example of what is going on in the United States with the tornadoes and the flooding and, you know, the BP crisis and so on and so forth. What, I mean, why did this whole BP thing happen? It was because people had turned away from nuclear. That's the real reason. And cleaning up, you know, is much more difficult if you don't have high energy flux density energies, such as nuclear. So you end up having a much more dirty planet, much more polluted planet, because we're actually going away from the type of energy flux densities we need to actually make our planet more green and more beautiful, basically, because who doesn't like trees, right? The whole thing with the greenies is that they have this feel-good thing that, you know, the sort of, you know, your conscience feels better, you know, when you hug trees. But nobody thinks about, well, what is the symbiotic relationship between trees and the climate? For example, the main greenhouse gas is not CO2, and most people don't even know how much CO2 there is. They give you crazy statistics like 5% of the atmosphere is CO2. If it was, you know, we wouldn't be able to live here. But they have no idea. But then they don't take the time to think about these types of things, to sit down and basically look at what we've done with the basement team and what we have on the Alpac website. How do these things actually work? They've monopolized the idea of green as being some sort of emotional utopia, some fantasy, without actually looking into the question of, you know, if it's scientifically, what is actually going on? And that is the real challenge that we have to bring across to people, mm-hmm. That what we try to challenge people with at this intervention, because they can say all sorts of weird things that sound good to them, but the question is, how does it actually work in practice? And is it really what's going to help anybody by them implementing this? And that's the main thing. That's one thing one of the journalists basically asked us a question after we had briefed them. So this thing basically that they are suggesting, these Schellenhuber people, it's not really going to work, is it?
Uh-huh.
But yes, it's actually not possible to implement what they're implementing. But if they start implementing this, it's going to spiral completely out of control at the moment when the whole system is collapsing, the euro is gone, and the United States is in a hyperinflationary collapse. What do you think will happen then if they even start going down that road?
Yeah, this was clear. Maybe that journalist saw the interchange. I encourage everyone to make a point of looking at the video clips from what Portia is describing. You'll see Portia, you'll see other people that were posted a few days ago on LaRouchePack.com on the news video updates. But you had one man you confronted about how are you going to support 9 billion people on just solar and wind power?
Right.
And he said something like, well, we're going to try. Is that right?
Yeah, he said that's our responsibility.
Okay.
See, this is, again, the whole global governance question, right? Our responsibility, it's extremely vague who we are, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of who's going to do that. But he wasn't going to confront the question of, what is the consequence going to be of doing that? Will it actually work or not? They're just going to do it anyway. And whatever, you know, the Africans or the Asians or the South Americans think, you know, in the so-called third world, well, you know, they don't have time to think about that anyway, so we're going to do it for them. So that's the arrogance that I talk about, this completely oligarchical idea that there are some people that are just born to make these types of decisions and the rest of everybody is supposed to, you know, just have it dished out and not ask any questions and be kept in the dark.
And to go back to when you first began, you said this was this Nobel laureate affair that was supposed to be, you know, it's like stealth. It's the third one since 2007, and they were,
right.
But it's to feed in their schemes. Now, we're not, that's our task in history. We're not going to let this happen. But in their scheme, it would feed into a 2012 new Rio conference. Is that the idea?
I think the next conference, right, they're going to give it to the United Nations in Rio, and then the next big climate conference is going to be in Durban, South Africa.
Oh.
And they're going to try again to get this whole CO2 emissions thing, you know, on a global level, again, that the governments agree to something after Kyoto. But that the interesting thing was the fact that that's what the Nobel laureates refused to sign, mm-hmm. this whole decarbonization. That was the point that they rejected, number two, on the question of stopping fossil fuels and nuclear.
Right. I will say here, I've sent it to Portia, the Gerald in Los Angeles, sent in a message of congratulations in advance to you and your colleagues, Portia, for conducting this operation to derail this.
Thank you.
And so I won't read it. I made sure that you got it personally. And he asked something that's been half answered by you and Alicia both, I think. That is, what is the identity to the present-day Nazis, these characters, the Schellnhuber and these other people who say, we're going to do what we're going to do, and the literal pedigree of the Nazis of the past in the way of eugenics? You spoke of Retzius and so forth, but do you want to say more about that, these royal families? It's a direct line.
It's decadence. I mean, if you're going to talk about the identity of these people, I don't think that they have in any sense a human or any type of moral identity. Because if you look at the history of, you know, empire, if you look at the British Empire, it's been a series of failures from beginning to the end.
Yeah.
They've you know, inbred so much that, you know, they've had cases of madness, they've had cases of, you know, it's just complete depravity, the way if you look at, you know, what Shakespeare goes through in the histories, you know, of the Henrys, the Wars of the Roses, and so on, it's just disgusting. And if you look at the case of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, you notice that you cannot separate the private life that they have, that they conduct, from what they're actually doing in their public life. I mean, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, as a modern-day Don Giovanni, I mean, he was raping nations, and it's not surprising in any way that he was doing that, you know, with women or whatever in his private life. And that is the key thing, that if we want to change society, what we have to do is we have to, in a sense, we have to give to normal people the sense that they are something special by divine right, as in that they are human, because oligarchs usually think that they have a right to just have a good life, to just be the ones that are running things, the stock market, nations, looting, you know, raw materials and so on. They think that they are entitled to that by whatever birth or whatever they decide is the reason. But the key question of humanity is that our entitlement is simply creativity, as LaRouche brings it up. And our immortality comes from the fact that we actually can give back or give to future generations. In a certain sense, the more that we give to humanity, the more we get out of it, because future generations can have a better life than we've had. And that's the thing. They're devoid of any sense of humanity in that sense. So it's really disgusting when you go into the history of, you know, oligarchs. It's very nasty.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we have all of the visions come, which you mentioned, about the literal British Empire, the British East India Company. We had the famous colonial figures in American colonial history of the governor of New Jersey, who used to run around in his ball gowns and denounce anything good that anyone wanted to do for public good.
Right.
Hundreds and hundreds of years of insanity. But so did you have any occasion you're in Sweden now, in Stockholm, any onlookers, bystanders or others that you encountered, or was this a kind of closed environment in the Royal Academy of Sciences Park?
Well, some students and onlookers and passers-by obviously were very interested to find out what we were doing, because we created quite a stir. I mean, they called the police on us, and, you know, when the police came, we had, you know, very loud and raucous discussions with them, and they decided that we could stay. But in fact, it was very good that they came, because they actually protected us from this one guy. who's the vice president of the Club of Rome, Anders Schiefmann, who's an old, acquaintance of ours. We've met him on several occasions.
What's his name again, Portia? Give his
Anders
name.
Anders Schiefmann.
Okay.
Anders Schiefmann. Mm-hmm. He came up, you know, in a huge car and, parked it right in front of the Royal Academy. And he came up and, you know, strutted out. And we asked him, you know, why he's not on his bike today. And, you know, since he's emitting so much CO2, and he got really agitated by that. He said he had to, you know, be mobile today. And then we said, well, maybe Africans and people in the third world also need to be mobile and have technologies. And he almost, you know, tried to physically attack us. But it was a good thing the police was there, actually, to stop that from happening. I think he remembered the time when we gave him a noose to hang himself so that his dream of, you know, having 500 million people as the maximum carrying capacity of the planet could be fulfilled in him making the first step. So that was a good thing.
Well, before we get near the end, one thing I want to have everyone please pay attention to this, or know what you want to put in your search service engine. This blue revolution, greening the desert, wonderful video that brings together a lot of what Portia was just talking about, can be found on the following site. It's the Schiller Institute site of Germany. Now that's at Schiller-Institute, which is spelled without an E, to spell it in the German way, .de for Deutschland. So that's Schiller-Institut, which is institute.de, under new videos. And it's in English as well as German. I understand it's in Arabic. Would you say more? Do you want to say more about to people to wield this as inspiration for the world? Portia?
Well, what comes to mind is this question of justice. We've been talking about all these evil eco-fascists,
right.
But then the other side of the thing is, what are we going to do now that we have the situation that we have? I mean, there are so many people around the planet, and I think Americans should know this or do know this already. The question of Glass-Steagall being implemented in the U.S. is a question of life and death for, you know, the majority of people on this planet, if not everybody. And the Blue Revolution is something that cannot be implemented unless Glass-Steagall is pushed through. And you see what's going on in the Middle East. You see what's going on in Northern Africa and the Arab world. You see the devastation. You see, the crimes that have been committed. But then how do we address that or redress it? It's not by, you know, running around and killing, you know, people, or, you know, taking them to the ICC or something like that. But it's the real question of addressing the system. And I think the question of the Blue Revolution and the development of the planet is the only way we can actually have real justice around the world. So I would encourage people to look into that.
Right. And otherwise, people are, would you say something, you work closely with Helga Zepp LaRouche, and the Schiller Institute internationally has been gaining signatures of scientists and others. It's like the process you described in Stockholm, where you said, where your efforts made even this fascist scheme to outlaw carbon-based fuels and nuclear power fail a bit, right? But the signature gathering campaign and so forth, would you go ahead and describe that process?
Well, that's ongoing. This is something that is very important for the whole of Europe, especially Germany right now, because we are trying to get any sentient being, but especially, you know, people in positions, in the scientific community, in politics, who still care about the future of their grandchildren. And what's happening right now with, for example, in Germany, Mrs. Merkel is still bent on shutting down all the nuclear power plants in the country. And Germany is a highly industrialized nation. It's the heartland of an industry and technological development in all of Europe. And if that happens, you know, it's not just candlelight dinners, but, you know, it's the question of whether or not we can actually implement things like the Blue Revolution and the development that we need in Asia and other places around the world. It's impossible if they actually start shutting these things down, because it's not like you can just switch them back on, you know, by turning a switch or something. But, you know, they rust and, you know, they age and you have to train people again and so on and so forth. So this is something that it cannot be allowed to happen. So this is something we're really pushing so that we can actually make sure that once Glass-Steagall is implemented, we can hit the ground running.
Well, that ends our time. It's flown by, and that is the kind of call to action, continued action, and escalated holy hell that we're wielding here in the United States. Congress is back again. Part of them were out in their home districts, and we got after a lot of them. So that begins Monday. So we're going to go for it like crazy. And thank you, Portia, very much, and we'll be talking to you again. This will end our May 21st LaRue show. We thank Portia Törnborg-Strid in Stockholm. Thank you.
Thank you, Basha.
Bye-bye.
Bye.